Numbers chapter 22, the 10th talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on July 3, 2005, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to be looking at Numbers, chapter 22. I've been working my way through the narrative portion of Numbers for quite a few months when I teach. My plan, I would like to do, I'm going to finish up Numbers, and I don't think that will take much longer because there isn't much more narrative in historical narrative in Numbers. And I haven't decided what I'm going to do next. I'm either going to do Joshua or skip to 1 Samuel, but I'd like to do something a little different. But I would also like to continue in the historical narrative of the Old Testament. I think it's excellent background for all of us, and it's interesting stuff. Now, let me just refresh your memory as to where we are historically and what's been happening that leads up to this particular event in chapter 22. As you will recall, this all began back in Egypt. When God came to the children of Abraham, they were enslaved by the Egyptians at the time. God sent Moses to them to lead them out of slavery in Egypt and to return them to the promised land as had been promised to Abraham and his descendants. So with signs and wonders, God led them out of Egypt. He sent the plagues on the Egyptians so that the Pharaoh would let them go. He finally relented. They left. And then the Pharaoh changed his mind and came after them, pinning them up against the Red Sea with Pharaoh coming. And God opened up the Red Sea and the Israelites went through. So it was a very dramatic event that occurred that allowed the Israelites to leave Egypt. And news of those events spread throughout the known world at the time, and that becomes a very important part of this story later on. Then, having gone through the Red Sea, they make their way through the Sinai Desert. And as they're making their way to Mount Sinai, the Israelites begin to grumble about their living conditions, food and water in particular. God's response to their grumbling is to provide the things that are needed. He takes care of them in miraculous ways. They make their way to Mount Sinai, and there God gives them the law. God tells them how they are to conduct themselves, what they are to value. Then after they receive the law, they proceed further through the wilderness, making their way towards Canaan. And now they continue to grumble. But now when they grumble, the pattern is God punishes them for their faithlessness. He had not done that prior to Mount Sinai, but after Mount Sinai, that tends to be the pattern. They go through the wilderness, make their way to the southern edge of Canaan, the promised land. And God says, go in and take it. I'll be with you. But the people of Israel, the Israelites, are afraid to do so. They will not go in, and as a result, God scolds them and says, okay, don't. And they say, we're sorry, we will go in, we will take the land. God says, no, don't. They go in anyway, and they are beaten badly. And as a result of that incident, God says, you will die in the wilderness. I'm taking you back in the wilderness, and you will die there. It will be the next generation that will go into the promised land, not you. So for 40 years, they wander around, apparently staying in just a handful of places for extended periods of time. But they spend 40 years in the desert, that whole generation dies out. A new generation comes along, and then God says, okay, it's time to move. It's time to get position ourselves to go back into the promised land. So God starts to take them up the east side of the promised land. It's called Transjordan. Edom is the first kingdom that they come to, and they ask the Edomites permission to pass through their land. And the Edomites say, no, you can't go through. And God says, okay, we'll go around them. So they go around the Edomites. The next people that they come to are of Arad, and those people attack the Israelites and take some of them, kidnap some of them. And the Israelites appeal to God, say, help us get those people back. And God says, attack them, and I will guarantee your victory. They attack them, they are successful, and they're able to get the kidnapped victims back. Then they move further north to Moab, and there the king is Sihon. They, with by God's instructions, attack Sihon, and they defeat him. And then they attack Og of Bashan, which is further north, and they defeat him. So God has, after the 40 years, God starts to bless them with successes in battle. What's interesting is the people did not stop grumbling. They did not all of a sudden stop being faithless and become faithful, and then God gives them successes. They continue to grumble and to be disobedient, but God has chosen to act differently in their lives. And God has begun to grant them successes and move them to position them to move into the promised land. So now, at this point, they are on the plains of Moab, right across the Jordan River from Jericho. That's where the action takes place for the rest of Numbers. And then that's where Deuteronomy takes place. And then in Joshua, they move into the promised land. Now, just a little bit of geography. If you make a cross-section of Israel, starting from the Mediterranean Sea and moving to the east, there is a coastal plain, which in parts of Israel is very narrow, and in the southern part it widens out. The land slopes gently up as you go east, and until you get to the central hills that run right up, it's kind of the spine of Israel. Jerusalem is perched on the top of that spine of hills. That spine of hills rises to an elevation of about 3,000 feet. Then just east of that, it drops off fairly steeply. It goes down to the Arabah, that rift. It's the deepest rift on the face of the earth that's not under the sea. And the Jordan River runs down that rift into the Dead Sea, and then there's more of that rift south of the Dead Sea. And that's sometimes called the Arabah. That goes way down, and it even goes below sea level in parts of it. Then it goes steeply up. Just east of that rift, it goes steeply up to about 4,000 feet. And then it levels off. As a result, they have a phenomenon that's similar to what we have in the Cascades, and that is marine air that's coming in. As the clouds are forced to rise as they come against the hills, they drop water. So there's quite a bit of rainfall that falls along that central ridge that Jerusalem is perched on, but that's 3,000 feet. Then it goes over the rift, and then the clouds have to rise again when they get on the other side of the Jordan, and again they drop rain. So there's a narrow strip across the top of that, at the beginning of that ridge on the Transjordan, where they get between 10 and 20 inches of rain per year. But then you get just past that, and it is dry, dry, dry. So it's the way I think of it. I've never been there, but the way I think of it is, it's a lot like driving over the Cascades, and you see that there's that band just on the other side of the Cascades where they get a fair amount of rain. They get 10 to 20 inches. So that's like the Sisters area and the Black Butte area. But you move further east from that, and it dries out very quickly, and you can just tell that by looking at the foliage, that the vegetation. So there's a similar phenomenon. So it's right along that edge of the Transjordan that's populated at this time. If you go further east, there's nobody except a few nomads. It's really desert. But right along that ridge, there is a fair amount of population. And that is the route that God is taking the Israelites on as they come to the place where they're going to move into the promised land. That was a major thoroughfare in certainly in the time of Abraham. It's less of a major thoroughfare at this time, but it's still one of the major routes to go from Mesopotamia to Egypt. Okay, chapter 22, the first six verses. Then the sons of Israel journeyed and camped in the plains of Moab, beyond the Jordan opposite Jericho. Now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. So Moab was in great fear because of the people, for they were numerous, and Moab was in dread of the sons of Israel. And Moab said to the elders of Midian, "Now this horde will lick up all that is around us, as the ox licks up the grass of the field." And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of Moab at the time. So he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river, in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, "Behold, a people came out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the surface of the land, and they are living opposite me. Now, therefore, please come, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." So the Israelites have camped in this plain after they have defeated Sihon and Og. And those were the two big kings. Those were the two most powerful kings on the east side of the Jordan. So they've defeated them. Now they're camped in this plain. Now, Balak is the king of a people that had been conquered by Sihon and was subservient to him. So Sihon's dead, and Balak and his people now are liberated in a sense. But they're looking out at this mass of Israelites, and they're scared to death. Now, what's indicated here is it's the numbers that scares them. There are so many of them. But God had told the Israelites before they started to move towards the promised land that he was going to precede them with word of what had happened in Egypt. And indubitably that has happened. That Balak and the others know what happened in Egypt and have to be concerned. That here is something coming that has divine assistance that's making it possible for them to be successful. So Balak looks out at all these people, is scared to death, and the only thing that he can think to do is, I have to form an alliance. I have to find other people to ally with in order to take on the Israelites because they're so numerous. But even that is not going to be enough. Beyond that, I need divine assistance. So he's going to appeal to a seer. And a seer in Mesopotamian culture is one who can see what is going to happen. A seer is one who knows in advance how world events are going to turn out. That's one of his special powers. The other special power that a seer has is he has the ability to drive a wedge between the God of a people and that people. The way they saw the world, every group of people has their own God. And how they fare in the world depends on how their relationship with that God is going. Are they serving that God well? Are they doing what that God wants? And if they are, then things will go well. If they stop doing the right sacrifices and that sort of thing, then they run the risk of alienating their God, their protector, and then they will be at the mercy of other forces out there. A seer is one who can drive that kind of wedge between a people's God and the people themselves. And apparently that's what they are going to call on Balaam to do. As Balak looks out over the Israelites, he sees that they cover the ground. And the Israelites have flocks with them. The people who live in Transjordan are shepherds. They have flocks themselves. And this is in a piece of land that there's quite a bit of pasture, but that has to spread a long ways. The fear is the Israelites are going to consume all of the pasture and the people, Balak and his people, are going to starve as a result of this influx of people. He says that what's the term he uses? They cover the surface of the land. It's interesting because that's the same expression that was used when the plagues came on Egypt, that the locusts would cover the surface of the land. So there's a sense in which Balak is likening the Israelites to a plague, the plague that afflicted Egypt. So he's choosing to see these Israelites as a curse, as a plague to him. And this will become significant later on. So he wants to appeal to Balaam, a seer, for help. And he picks out Balaam because, he says in verse 6, "For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." This phrase is also interesting because this phrase has occurred elsewhere. God, in one of his blessings on Abraham, had said, he who blesses you will be blessed, and he who curses you will be cursed. So Balak is getting it just backwards. Next section, 7 through 14. "So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the fees for divination in their hand. And they came to Balaam and repeated Balak's words to him. And he said to them, 'Spend the night here, and I will bring word back to you as the Lord may speak to me.' And the leaders of Moab stayed with Balaam. Then God came to Balaam and said, 'Who are these men with you?' And Balaam said to God, 'Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab, has sent word to me. Behold, there is a people who came out of Egypt, and they cover the surface of the land. Now come, curse them for me. Perhaps I may be able to fight against them and drive them out.' And God said to Balaam, 'Do not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed.' So Balaam arose in the morning and said to Balak's leaders, 'Go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you.' And the leaders of Moab arose and went to Balak and said, 'Balaam refused to come with us.'" So a delegation is sent to visit Balaam. Balaam lives near Carchemish. If you look on the maps if you've got a map in your Bible, it's north. It's quite a ways north. It's about 360 miles north. So this is quite a trip that this delegation is undertaking. So they go this 360-mile trip to the north to meet with Balaam. And they've got money with them to pay for his services. And they tell him what Balak had said, that they've got these Israelites on their doorstep that need to be dealt with. And they need his help in doing that. Now, Balaam's response is, spend the night here, and perhaps, it says, spend the night, I will bring word back to you as the Lord may speak to me. And the word here translated Lord is Yahweh. Now that's significant in that that is the name that God said, spoke to Moses. That is what God said that he was to be called by the people of Israel, Yahweh. It is unusual for a non-Israelite to refer to God as Yahweh. And it's hard to know what to make of this. Why would Balaam refer to him as Yahweh? Now, it's possible that Balaam is one of those rare individuals who has come to know the one who is not an Israelite, but has come to know the one true God as the God of the universe. Melchizedek comes to mind as one who could fit that description. And it could be in that for that reason that he refers to God as Yahweh. But as we go through the rest of the narrative in Numbers, I think that's highly unlikely. Balaam, as we'll see later in Numbers, and then particularly as he's depicted in the New Testament, is not a good guy. Balaam is a very bad guy, and we'll see that later. So I don't think that Balaam is one who recognizes Yahweh as the one true God. My suspicion, therefore, is that the reason he uses Yahweh is because he has been told by this delegation that has come. He's been given the whole background and story of these Israelites, of how they came out of Egypt and how they made their way to the Transjordan, that they worshiped this God Yahweh, and Yahweh has been blessing them and moving them along on their journey. So my suspicion is that Balaam has been told all of this, and then he refers to this God Yahweh as the one that he will try to gain contact with. In any case, it is interesting how often Yahweh is used throughout this passage. Whenever it says Lord, if you've got in most translations, that indicates that Yahweh is the word in the Hebrew. So then during the night, God does indeed come to Balaam. It's interesting that the text then switches. It says, then God came to Balaam. God there would be Elohim, the broader kind of term for God, the more universal term for God. So God comes to Balaam during the night, and he says, who are these people? And Balaam explains who they are, where they come from, what their request is. And God says two things to Balaam that he is not to do. Do not go with them, and do not curse them because they are blessed. So two prohibitions. Balaam gets up in the morning. He talks to the delegation that's come from Balak, and he says, I'm not going with you. God has forbidden that. And so the people, the delegation, they get up and they leave without Balaam going. Okay, who is this Balaam? There is extra biblical information about Balaam. Not much, but there is a little bit. In the Transjordan area, near where this is occurring, on the river Jabbok, in 1967, I believe, there was a small building discovered that had been apparently...
Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the remainder of this talk.